Hello, and welcome to David's Book Talk. And today we have a very special guest. His name is Zach Hampel, and he's written a book that is just out called The Baseball. It's Stunts, Scandals, and Secrets Beneath the Stitches, and it's just out from Anchor Books. And he's here to join us. Hello.
Well, hey there. Thanks for having me.
Hi. It's good to have you on the show. I'm just so enjoying this book. This is quite a book. You've been on a lot of different shows, I see.
Yeah, I do have a rather media-friendly hobby. I caught more baseballs as a fan at Major League games than anybody ever. And it's fun to talk about, and it's fun to do, and yeah, I've certainly made the rounds on some shows over the years.
It must be fun to be in the spotlight.
And it's a lot of fun.
For things that you did, and this is something you enjoy immensely, obviously, or you wouldn't be doing it.
Of course, yeah. Baseball has always been my number one passion / obsession, and it's great. Anytime I get to share something that I love with a bigger audience, it's great. And I never imagined that something as simple and dorky, really, as just going to games and catching balls would turn into such a big thing. But I've kind of been able to transform it into somewhat of a career and raise some money for charity at the same time and connect a lot more to the sport that I love, and I think help other people do the same. So I'm really grateful for that.
Right, now you dedicated this to your dad. Is your dad still alive?
No, he died in September, and he was with me when I was putting the finishing touches on the book, and he knew it was going to be published. And I thought for a long time actually how to dedicate the book, and I had some other ideas that he thought were pretty hilarious, actually, but ultimately when things went down as they did, I decided to scrap those plans and dedicate it to him.
Oh, that's nice. Now, the first part of the book, baseball in the news, is one of my favorite parts. It goes through all the different balls and who has caught them, and do I have that right? Am I looking at the right chapter here?
Yeah, the book is written in three parts, basically. The first part is baseball's in the news, the second part is historical and factual stuff, and the third part is called How to Snag Major League Baseballs. And the first part of the book, the book itself, I really tried to look at the sport through the lens of the ball, to talk about sort of the cultural and historical significance of the ball, but not just how it's manufactured. There's a huge chapter on that, but really sort of like the impact that the baseball has in our lives and just all the wacky stuff and the controversial things. And, you know, like I have a whole chapter called Death by Baseball, where I talk about players, fans, and even a few unlucky birds who've been killed by balls over the years.
That was the Dave Winfield incident.
Yeah, Dave Winfield, when he was on the Yankees and playing in Toronto, in between innings, he threw a baseball that struck and walked across the field. And it was believed, at least by some people, that he had done it on purpose. And after the game, he was arrested for animal cruelty and could have faced 6 months in jail, but the charges were ultimately dropped. And Billy Martin, who was the team's manager then, joked that it was the first time all season that Winfield had hit the cutoff man. So, you know, there's definitely some tacky humor in the book, which could be more tasteful. But, you know, I just try to present all sides of it and just try to capture really the silliness and craziness surrounding the baseball.
Now it's over 4,000 balls, right?
It's true, yeah.
You've gotten 4,000 balls. Do you still have all the balls today?
Not all of them, and the current total is 4,662 baseballs. That's the lifetime.
What's your goal?
I was just going to say that I don't still have them all because I've given away a lot of baseballs to kids over the last few years, but I still have most of them, and at this point, my goal is just to enjoy being a baseball fan. I was always so caught up in the numbers, and I still am. I mean, I just love numbers in general. I don't think you can be this crazed about baseball and not have some weird fetish for numbers. But I don't know. I'm probably going to catch my 5,000th ball this year. And, you know, will I end up with 10,000 balls someday? I don't know. It could happen. It's kind of crazy to think that everything that I've done, I basically have to do that again and then some. But I don't know. I don't anticipate not liking baseball anytime soon. And as long as it's a big part of my life, I'm sure I'll still go to games and catch balls and help kids out there figure out how to catch baseballs for themselves. And I don't know. It's just it's kind of crazy that it's come this far, but I don't see myself stopping anytime soon.
No, you all love it. Why would you stop something you love? I mean, it's
exactly.
Not like who even thinks about retiring or anything? You just enjoy it. I mean, when you enjoy it and you can still get to the games and still afford to go and still are still able to get tickets and
I'm 33 years old, so you know, according to some people, I'm way too old to be bringing a glove to baseball games. But you know, according to how I feel, I feel like a kid. I have a lot of energy. I'm in good shape. I love running around and I played college baseball and, you know, catching a 400-foot fly ball in the stands, even navigating railings and steps and seats really isn't that hard for me, and it's just something that I love to do. And ultimately, what it comes down to is that I just love baseball, and going to games and chasing baseball just makes me feel connected to the sport.
So how long does it take to get to be an expert at ball hawking? That's what you call yourself, like a ball hawker.
Yeah, ball hawk really is the term that's taken over. I never really knew the term ball hawk until a few years ago when this whole community started growing, and that really happened because of the internet. There are guys who have been doing this for decades. There are some legendary ball hawks in Chicago that hang out on Waveland Avenue outside of Wrigley Field who've also collected thousands of balls. But I just didn't know about these guys when I was 14 in 1992, and I just started going to a lot of games. I thought I was the only one doing it. I mean, I figured there were others, but I didn't think anyone had more baseballs than me. But it's wonderful to see how this community has blossomed over the last few years.
And some of the ball hawkers, your fellow ball hawkers, are actually in the book, and you go through, and it's fascinating to look at these guys and see what they've done. And you ask them questions, too, which I thought was really, that's really interesting, the way you did that.
Yeah, you know, thank you. I feel like I've sort of become almost like the spokesman or the go-to guy in this hobby, because my first book was called How to Snag Major League Baseballs, and that came out in 1999. And I only had about 1,200 baseballs at the time, and it turns out that back then there were other guys that had even more baseballs than that, but I didn't know about them, and the media didn't really know about them that much because, you know, like I said, I'm the one that happened to write the book about it. So I've kind of become that guy, and I've gotten a lot of attention, which has been great, but there are a lot of other guys who do this that also deserve attention, and they've done their share of big interviews as well. But certainly I think most of the attention has come my way, and part of the reason why I wanted to include them in the book is not only just because they're hilarious characters and they have interesting stories to tell, but I kind of wanted to, you know, shine the spotlight back on them a little bit because they're awesome guys, and they deserve it. And the world, the baseball world at least, should know about them.
And one thing I always wonder about, and is how the people who go to a lot of these games, how they work and go to the games at the same time. Is it difficult for you, or do you just go to all night games? And how do you arrange all this? It must be a lot of rearranging your schedule.
Yeah, well, it's different for everybody. It is hard to have a regular, steady career and go to a lot of games, although there are certainly guys that do that. Other ball hawks who, you know, have been doing this for a long, long time kind of adjust their life schedules where they'll work extra hard in the winter and kind of clear up more time in their schedules to go to games in the summer. As far as me, it's really kind of connected to what I do. You know, my third book, The Baseball, just came out. And I find that the more games that I go to and the more I blog about it, the more people kind of discover me and the more interview requests I end up getting and the more people who want to pay to go to games with me. I run a business called Watch with Zach where I take people to games and guarantee that they'll get at least one ball.
Is that
and
right?
So,
How cool is that?
Yeah.
Well, see, that's the good part of it. You give back to other people, so you're not just out to get as many balls as you can and keep them all for yourself. I mean, you share them with others, and that's important. I mean, this is a world where, you know, a lot of people don't like sharing, so it's good to share.
Well, I have to admit that I haven't always been the best at sharing myself. I grew up as an only child, and when I was more of a child myself, I did keep every baseball that I got, but I try to give away at least one ball every game I go to, and sometimes two or three. So, you know, of course there are people who still think that I should be giving away more baseballs than that, but I just try to remind them, you know, most people don't even catch two baseballs in their lifetimes, and I'm giving away that many every single game. So, I don't know, I just found that I can't ever please everybody, so I just try to have fun and do what I feel is right, and, you know, just kind of take it from there.
Now, you actually caught a very famous ball. Didn't you catch one of Barry Bonds' balls?
I did. Bonds' 724th career home run in 2006 at Petco Park in San Diego.
Is that worth some money, that ball, that particular home run? Was that...
You know, when I caught that ball, I was hoping that stadium security would whisk me off into an underground bunker and tell me that Mr. Bonds wanted the ball back or Cooperstown wanted it, but none of that happened. It was, unfortunately, shortly after he passed Babe Ruth on the all-time list and a season or so before he passed Hank Aaron, so it kind of fell right in the middle there, but it's still, I've gotten estimates ranging from maybe $5,000 to $10,000 for that ball. I think the bond market and the market in general for milestone home run balls has come down in recent years. I mean, Bonds is just not a likable character, and so that's really hurt the value of his home run balls. I actually caught a ball that I think is even more historic than that. I caught the last Mets home run ever hit at Shea Stadium. And to me, the Bonds home run was great, but that's really just an individual player. The Mets ball, to me, kind of represents an entire franchise and an entire stadium. So that one is actually my favorite ball that I've ever caught at a game.
Now, there's 10 balls listed here that people have caught. And here's one, Mark McGwire's 70th home run of 1998. It's worth $3 million.
Yeah, I have a top 10 list in the book, the most expensive baseballs of all time that were hit and caught and sold. And McGwire's 70th, that record-breaking final home run from 98, was bought by Todd McFarlane, who's the creator of Spawn comic books.
Oh, yes, I know the name. Yeah.
So the guy has a lot of money, and he loves baseball, and he bought that thing. And then, of course, just a few years later, Barry Bonds ended up breaking McGwire's record, and that final ball sold for $450,000, but then when you add up the various fees and buyer's premium and all that, it was a little bit over $500,000, and that was a pretty famous ball because crazy controversy that I talked about in the book. Basically, the ball was hit in San Francisco at AT&T Park, and you can see on the television replays that the ball went into the glove of one guy up on the section in right field known as the arcade. But there was such an intense scrum that the guy who caught it kind of got knocked down, pulled to the ground. And while he was down, the ball popped out of his glove, and some other dude came up with it. And these two guys basically took each other to court. The guy who initially had the ball in his glove sued the guy who ended up getting it, and it was this huge court battle, and an entire movie, a documentary, was made about this ball and the battle in court for it called Up for Grabs. It's a great film. If anyone out there has not yet seen it, definitely check it out.
That's amazing. Now, I know this season Dick Tomey's going to get his, I think it's his 500th?
600, I believe.
Is it 600? Okay. Now, will you be there to try to get that?
Well, I hope so. It really depends on where he's going to be hitting it and what my schedule is like. You know, if I had unlimited time and money, I would just probably follow the Twins around until he hits it. But there are some stadiums where it's really not even worth my time to be there. The trick for catching batted ball. I mean, there's a lot of tricks to get players to toss you balls during batting practice.
And if you read this book,
during the game.
And if you read this book, you know a lot of the tricks. You reveal a lot of how to do it, of a lot of where to look and where
absolutely,
to stand.
Yeah.
And
every possible strategy I've ever come up with in the last two decades is in the final third of this book. And you know, for people out there listening who don't really care about catching balls or they don't see what the big deal is, it's still a fun part of the book. I tried to write it in a really conversational way, and there are a lot of stories in there that aren't even necessarily directly related to how to catch balls, but just kind of show some of the wackiness that takes place out in the bleachers, interacting with the players and whatnot. But the best way to catch a batted ball is to make sure that you have some room to run left and right. It's all about lateral mobility. So you never want to be trapped in the middle of a long row of fans, because the odds of a ball coming right to you are very slim, even if you think you're in the best spot. And then even if a ball were to come right to you, you know, you might get knocked over by someone sitting on either side of you. There might be a guy who's 7'4" sitting right in front of you who'll jump up and catch it. So you want to be out in the open. It's great if there's a cross aisle where you can run left and right, or even better yet, a standing room only section. Even maybe a tunnel that sort of opens up into the stands where you can kind of hang out for a pitch or two here and there. So you got to have room to run. There are some stadiums that provide no room to run at all. And I wouldn't really waste my time, for example, going to a sold-out Yankee Stadium, because there's no aisles, there's no standing room, and you're pretty much dead as a ball hawk when you're at Yankee Stadium. But on the other hand, Kansas City, for example, Kauffman Stadium, there's a lot of room to run all over the outfield. There are walkways and standing room only and cross aisles. And, of course, there aren't nearly as many fans who go to the games in Kansas City. So it really depends on where Tommy is when he gets to 598, 599.
And will you be able to get tickets? That's the thing, too. I mean, once he gets close to 600, the tickets are going to be harder to get, I would think, depending on where he is. More so if he's at home than away.
Well, yeah, that's true. And Target Field does have a huge standing room only section in right field. So there's a lot of room to run there, but there are two problems with it. Number one, there are a lot of seats between the outfield wall and the standing room only section, so a batter has to hit a colossal home run just to reach the standing room. Number two, Target Field is very crowded. I mean, they were basically sold out for all of last season, and this coming season is just going to be the second year of the ballpark, and the Twins are a great team. They have some great players, so you know, there's going to be a major crowd out there if Tommy comes up at 599. Tickets in general are not a problem for me. I try to avoid games that are sold out. Like, I have no intention. I never attend opening day because it's always nuts.
Madness, yeah.
And if I ever do want to attend a game that's going to be packed, well, I just go online, check out StubHub, and you know, I always pretty much buy the cheapest seat in the stadium and then try to maneuver around from there. So, I don't know, tickets are not really a problem for me. People always wonder, how do you afford it, and do you have season tickets? And often I don't even decide that I'm going to go to a game until I wake up that day and I kind of read my emails and see if I'm busy, and I look at the weather and see if it's going to rain, and then I kind of make my decision from there. Of course, if I'm traveling and going to games in other cities, then I have to book stuff in advance. But even then, getting tickets is not that big of a deal.
Now, do you have favorite stadiums? I mean, if I asked you for your three favorites, would you be able to rattle them off right now?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it becomes a little bit arbitrary because there are certain ballparks that are better for certain reasons. But I think Camden Yards is really my favorite. I just love how laid back it is there, and the actual architectural layout of the stadium is ideal for catching baseballs.
Hmm.
I love Rangers Ballpark in Arlington. I love Turner Field in Atlanta.
Now, you'll get to all three of those this year?
I'm hoping to go to all 30 stadiums this year.
Wow.
I've already been to them all. I've been to 48 Major League stadiums altogether, because I've been to a bunch that have closed down and aren't around anymore. But I've never been to all 30 in a season, and I would probably guess that that no one else has ever, or no one, period, has ever snagged at least one ball in all 30 stadiums in one season.
And what a cool book that would be if you wrote a book about all the different stadiums you were in and your experiences. That would be an interesting book.
That would be pretty neat. I mean, for now, I just write a blog where people can read all of my stories and see my photos and read the strategy.
Now, where can they get to your blog?
The blog is called The Baseball Collector, so if you just do a search for that, you'll find it. The blog is it's kind of under construction right now because I blog through MLB.com, and they just switched over from one blog provider to another, so some of the photos and links are a little bit screwy at the moment, but I'm told that everything should be back up and running soon. It's been a great blogging experience with them and being able to connect to so many people online.
And even in this book, you can even see the inside of a baseball, which is fascinating. You get to see all what is really inside of a baseball, what they do, and the stitching. They say, and like you said in the book, the stitching, it's hard to stitch a baseball. It's not as easy as you might think.
It is very hard. And I think one thing that a lot of people don't realize is that despite all the technology that we have in the world, baseballs are still hand-stitched. Now, the inside of the ball is made with four different layers of yarn and thread, and those are wound around the core of the ball by machines. And it's an incredibly precise process. I was lucky enough to get to go visit the Rawlings Baseball Factory in Costa Rica last year.
Which is well guarded, from what you're saying.
Oh, my goodness. It's absolutely not open to the public, and it's really not even open to the media.
So how did you get in?
Well, before I went there, the last reporter to get in was nearly a decade earlier. Someone from the Boston Globe had gotten in and written a story about the baseballs. I was able to get in because I had made some connections at the office of the Commissioner of Major League Baseball, really without even knowing it. I just called them up to do some research for the book, and it turned out that some people there had already heard of me and then invited me in to ask my questions in person. And once I got there, the topic of the factory came up, and they said, "Oh yeah, you know, we can contact Rawlings for you, and we can set up a visit of the factory, no problem."
Wow, how cool is that?
It still took a year from that point to actually set it up. I mean, that's how difficult it is. Even with MLB's blessing, telling Rawlings, "Yeah, this guy is cool, you can let him in," it still took a year. The inside of the baseball, it's like everybody has seen a baseball, most people have held a baseball, and yet how many of us have really seen the guts of a ball? I mean, anyone could just take one apart and look, but for some reason, no one really does. And I did sort of walk the reader through taking apart a ball, unraveling it, and then in my Rawlings chapter, I explained how it's actually built from the inside out.
So this book took, would you say, over a year's worth of work to get and compile all this stuff and figure out what you were going to put in, what you were going to talk about, and all the different sections?
Yeah, it took a year and a half, and it was a full-time job and then some. I signed a contract with Random House up front for the book, so I was guaranteed some money, so I was able to take time off from my other job and just do nothing for a year and a half but work on this book. And the biggest challenge probably wasn't even the writing of the book so much as it was really just organizing all the material, figuring out what I wanted to include, doing the research, taking notes, boiling it down. It was intense, man. It was quite a process. And I thought this book was going to be easier to write than my last one, Watching Baseball Smarter, because I figured, oh, you know, it's about baseballs and snagging baseballs, and I know this subject material inside and out, and, you know, no problem. And, man, was I wrong. I learned so much stuff in the process of researching this book, and it's definitely a labor of love.
Now, do we know how many baseballs were used last year in both leagues together?
Well, Rawlings makes about 1.3 million baseballs a year, and a lot of those get sold in retail stores to the public. The major leagues themselves use something like 700,000 balls a year, if I'm remembering the numbers correctly. You know, I'm almost ashamed to admit this, but I don't have every number memorized. I might be a nerd, but I'm not that big of a nerd. But it's all in the book. But it's something like, I think it's 700,000 balls get used in the major leagues each year.
That's a lot. I didn't realize it was that much. That's a lot of balls.
Oh, yeah.
But you got to figure there's a lot of foul balls. And
well, the average ball only lasts about 6 pitches. Because any time the pitcher bounces one, the catcher is going to hand it to the umpire, who will inspect it and almost always toss it out of play. And, you know, balls just get tossed into the crowd left and right, and there's foul balls and there's home runs and there's batting practice. I mean, teams go through dozens of balls every day in batting practice. And when the balls, if a ball even lasts long enough in BP to get beat up, it'll get sent down to the batting cages underground. And after it gets smacked around there for a couple weeks, it'll get sent down to the minor leagues. And so the baseball really follows a long journey from the factory into a game and then into the stands or wherever it may end up. It's pretty fascinating to see how it all plays out.
Now, have you made friends with some baseball players? I mean, just from going to different parts, do they know you by sight, and do they help you out, some of them?
You know, over the years, I've actually tried to avoid getting to know players, because when I first started doing this, I realized that whenever players recognized me, it usually meant that they would never give me another baseball, because they'd recognize me as that guy that has more baseballs than anyone, and why does he need another one? But there have been some really cool guys over the years who've gotten to know me and still continue to give me baseballs despite everything they knew about me in my collection. And the coolest of them all is Heath Bell. I mean, that guy is the man. And it was so good with Heath that a couple years ago he made a donation to the charity that I've been raising money for. Basically, I've been getting people to pledge a little bit of money for every ball that I catch. And the money adds up over the course of the season, goes to a charity called Pitch In for Baseball that provides baseball equipment to underprivileged kids all over the world.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, so Heath pledged 50 cents per ball, which might not sound like that much, but that year I caught over 500 balls.
Whoa.
So he ended up donating a few hundred dollars to the charity. And on a personal level, the coolest thing he did for me was that he saved a ball for me from the World Baseball Classic a couple years ago. And he and I have become friendly, and we talk on the phone sometimes, and we would text back and forth and email. And so once he got this ball, which he knew that I wasn't going to be able to catch any other way, because I only go to major league games, not minor league or spring training or World Baseball Classic. And the World Baseball Classic ball had a very special commemorative logo stamped with gold. So he saved this ball for me and texted me to let me know that he would bring it to a game in Philadelphia. And, you know, I live in New York, and so I made a point to drive down there, and he brought the ball with him from the West Coast, and it was really cool. And then he surprised me by also giving me a baseball from the 2009 All-Star Game.
Now, do you go to all these games by yourself, or do you sometimes take people to help you catch the balls?
Well, I don't need any help, that's for sure. the way people will help sometimes is if a friend comes with me and is willing to take photographs of me in action, then I'll get some really cool action shots for my blog. And, you know, usually if I'm there with a friend or whoever, they'll often just sit down in one spot and watch the game like a normal person. So I'll leave my backpack with them, and I'm lighter on my feet, and I can run around easier. But I generally prefer to go to games by myself. I know a lot of people, and I have a lot of friends, and I just have a really busy social life in general. And I don't know, it's sort of like friends are friends, and baseball is baseball, and I kind of like to be left alone for the most part when I go to games. But like I said, I do run the business where I take people to games, so I do that quite a bit. And, you know, in that case, I'm happy to go with whoever. But otherwise, I'm often there by myself, and I'm cool with that.
Now, do you eat? You actually eat at these games? You usually pack your own lunch? And I mean, is it a whole planning thing with going to a game? Do you have to?
Yeah, good question. It sure is. When I'm on the road, everything is different, because it's just sort of harder to pack food, and you don't really know exactly when or where the next meal is going to come from. But when I'm home in New York, let's say, and I'm going to head off to a Mets or Yankees game, the stadium will open, well, Mets games, it opens 2.5 hours early. So let's say I'm going to a 7, 10 p.m. game. The stadium is going to open at 4:40. I want to get there by 4:15, so I'm the first in line. It takes about 45 minutes on the subway, sometimes an hour. So ideally, I'd walk out of my apartment at like 3:20 p.m. I try to eat as big a meal as I possibly can at about 3 o'clock. Sometimes I'll grab some pizza and eat it while I walk to the subway. Sometimes I'll grab a sandwich the night before and chow down in my apartment before I head out. And that meal will usually keep me full until about 8 o'clock or so. I try to make it through the first 3 innings of the game, and then I pull out a protein bar. I eat that thing, which knocks out my hunger for like 2 or 3 hours. So as long as the game doesn't go into extra innings, I can pretty much avoid having to eat at the stadium. And then by the time I get home, I'm starving and I eat another big meal. Stadium food is generally not that healthy, and it's kind of expensive. And
although they're talking about having healthier food this year, they've already talked about doing it at Citizens.
Yeah, but like if you go to do you really want to be like eating a salad when you're at a baseball game or eating sushi? I mean, especially me. My meals at a baseball game pretty much have to fit in within the duration of an inning break. So that's like grabbing a hot dog or a burger and chowing down really fast, or grabbing a slice of pizza. And, you know, it's not like I can't afford to buy a $20 meal or a $50 meal, but it's just like I don't like spending that much money if it's just like concession stand food. So I try to eat healthy and save some money by eating away from the stadium.
Now, can a person actually meet some of the players? Are there tricks to meeting some of the players if you really want to meet them and say hello or get an autograph? I mean, are there tricks that way that you know about?
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, spring training is a great way to do it just because there are fewer fans and everything is more laid back, and you can catch guys walking from the batting cages to the field or from a practice field to, you know, the training room. Everything's kind of out in the open more in spring training, so that's a great way. But during the regular season, just get to the stadium early, you know. Catch the players when they're getting out of their cars in the players' parking lot, or when the visiting team's bus rolls in, you know, just go hang out there. If you're wearing a hat or a shirt of the visiting team, that'll get their attention. You could make a sign with the player's name on it. Usually everybody who goes early and hangs out is there for an autograph. So I would say, you know, if you didn't want to get an autograph, you'd probably stand out even more. If you were just there to basically say hello to the players and not harass them about signing something, even after games, you know, you got to give them time to talk to the media and to shower. And, of course, it's late at night and they might not want to stop and hang out. But if you go to enough games and you're just there regularly, you'll definitely stand out to the players. You can get their attention inside the stadiums, too, just sort of get down, you know, near where the ball boys and ball girls would hang out down the lines. The players will come out and run and stretch and throw before game time. And, I don't know, throw on a wacky outfit, put on like a rainbow clown wig or something like that. Anything that's just going to make you stand out from the sea of fans.
Now, if anybody sees you at any of these games and they have this book with them, will you sign it for them?
Yes, of course. in fact, I get a lot of emails from people asking me to let them know when I'm going to be at their local stadium, and, you know, I want to meet you, and I want you to sign my book, and I want to, you know, watch what you do in batting practice and all this stuff. So, yeah, I hear from people all the time, and I usually will sign at least one autograph at every game that I go to. If it's not a book, it might be a baseball that someone caught and they want me to sign, or their ticket stub, or their program. It's kind of weird. I feel like a celebrity when I'm at a stadium, but then in the rest of my life, nobody ever knows who I am. So I guess it's kind of the best of both worlds. I can be anonymous when I need to, but, you know, kind of feel special when I go to games. So.
It's a shame they can't get you outside one of the stadiums or something and do a signing before the game or something. That would be great. You imagine all the people that would buy it. I mean, it's a great book, and it's only $15. I mean, it's a great deal.
Well, thanks.
There's so much in it. I mean, you get every bit of your money's worth. I mean, there's just so much in here. And I mean, the pictures, and I love the picture on the back of the balls that you have stacked into a pyramid. I just love that.
My author photo, yeah. I built a pyramid with a couple friends a few years back that was made out of about 2,800 baseballs. And
one of my friends
was a photographer, and he snapped some pics. And I never imagined at the time that it would end up being an author photo. I wasn't even working on this book at that time, but it is a pretty cool shot.
Now, what's holding the baseballs together in that picture?
The picture's a little bit too small. I wish they'd made it bigger, but you can kind of see that there's like a little wooden frame at the very bottom outer edges of the pyramid. I basically just went to like a lumber yard and I had measured sort of the width of, I forget how many baseballs were in the bottom layer. Let's say it was, you know, 20 baseballs wide, let's say. I measured how long 20 baseballs was, and I told them, yeah, I need 4 pieces of wood. It's going to cut like this. And they thought I was nuts when I told them why. And I nailed those wooden pieces together, and they cut nice little 45-degree angles so they'd fit well at the corners. And it was perfect. It held the bottom layer of balls in place so they wouldn't spread out and roll all over the floor. And then all the other baseballs stacked up on top of that.
Right. Now, do you have one team that you root for, or do you root for a lot of different teams, or do you, I mean, you don't seem like you're, I don't, we talked last night, but you didn't seem like there was one team that you liked more than another, or is there?
I root for the Padres because that's Heath Bell's team, and he's such a cool dude that,
right,
you know, I gotta root for my boy, but no, normally in general, I do not have a favorite team.
Why is that? I mean, did you have a favorite team growing up?
Yeah, I was a pretty serious Mets fan growing up, and you know, whenever I always loved players on other teams. Anyway, I collected probably over 100,000 baseball cards from the mid '80s to the mid '90s, and I loved looking at the stats on the backs of cards. And I kind of fell in love with a lot of players that way, and Greg Maddux was one of them. I just loved the stats that he put up, and of course, just being a baseball fan in general, I loved watching him play and watching him pitch. I loved how this sort of like schlumpy, average-looking white guy who was practically my size and really didn't throw that hard could make these big, muscle-bound hitters look stupid. So I just loved him. But when he was pitching for the Braves and the Braves came to play the Mets, I was sort of torn, and it's like, well, am I just supposed to now root against one of my favorite players because he happens to be playing the Mets? I mean, I guess most people would have said, yeah, of course you root against the guy. But for me, it was like, well, I didn't want to root against him. And I also just realized that the more the Mets lost, and this is completely selfish, I'm kind of ashamed to admit this, but the more the Mets lost, the fewer fans actually wanted to be there, and Shea Stadium would be nice and empty in September if the Mets were out of the pennant race, and I could basically run around and take the seat of my choice, and I just didn't have that much competition chasing baseballs. And so that was sort of like another, I felt myself sort of like secretly rooting against the Mets sometimes. And it just dawned on me, it's like, dude, you're not a Mets fan. Stop pretending that you're a Mets fan. You're just sort of like rooting for various things for various reasons. And there's so much player turnover anyway. I mean, your favorite player might be on your team one year, and then the next year it's like,
exactly,
again, who do you root for? So I don't have a favorite team. I just love baseball. I root for individuals, and I love to go to games and run around and catch balls.
You seem the happiest when you're at these games. I mean, is that when you are the happiest?
No. When I'm happiest, it usually involves some female company.
Oh, I didn't expect you to say that.
but I do certainly love baseball. Baseball stresses me out, though.
It does.
It's sort of like a love-hate relationship at times, because I get so into it during the season, and you know, it's like next week. I've gotten a bunch of emails recently from friends that are like, well, you know, hey, let's hang out. What are you doing next week? And it's like, I'm going to 5 games in 5 days in 2 cities, and I don't have time. Sorry. And I hate that. You know, I want to see my friends and hang out, But
I mean, you're a very down-to-earth guy, and I mean, you seem like you're always up for to have fun. So I mean, it's not like you don't want to. It's just that you have plans. You make a lot of plans in advance, and you have to.
Yeah, I just kind of feel like I have two lives, really. There's the baseball season life, the warmer weather life, that the public sees, and everybody thinks that I'm Mr. Baseball 365 days a year, and that's all I ever do and think about. But I actually enjoy my life a lot more when it's not baseball season, and I get so far away from the sport, you would not believe it. I have people emailing me in the winter, like, where are you going to be for Tommy's 600th home run, or like, what do you think about, you know, this team getting this player? I don't keep up with it at all. I don't read baseball headlines in the winter. I've never played fantasy baseball. I don't play in a men's 30 and older hardball league. I get as far away from baseball as I possibly can, except during the season when I'm at games or watching games on TV.
So after the season, I mean, will you work on another book during the season or after the season, or do you plan to write more books?
I don't know. I kind of really wore myself out on this book that just was published. And all I can say is that I need a full year break from writing anything serious. I'm still going to keep the blog going. I'm going to go to games. I'm going to blog it up and have a lot of fun that way. But I can't embark on a new project right now. Between the book wearing me down and my dad being diagnosed with cancer, and he got really sick at the same time, last year was the worst year of my adult life. I just need to, you know, be a 14-year-old kid for a summer and go to a lot of baseball games and just have fun and hang out with some friends when I have some time and just not really sweat the big stuff right now. So I worked full-time on the book for a year and a half, like no breaks at all. And so I feel like I've earned the right to not work and not write a whole lot this year and really just go to games, which is good for the book anyway, and travel around a little bit and
take notes, I assume. Take notes in case you do write another book.
Well, definitely. I mean, for now, all the notes, I guess, will be written up in blog entry format. But I'm not even thinking of the next book right now. I have some other projects in the works that I don't really want to get into right now because it's just sort of too soon. I don't want to jinx it or give anything away.
Absolutely.
But, you know, I always have some stuff cooking. But really, my priority right now is just to have a fun summer, go to a lot of games, raise a lot of money for charity, see some friends along the way, and just have laughs in the process.
And speaking of seeing people, do you ever meet anybody famous other than baseball players?
I'm sorry, do I meet who?
Do you ever meet anybody famous at these games besides baseball players? It is.
Well, I don't really meet famous people and talk to them at games. I mean, I was at a game that Bill Clinton went to, but I ended up meeting him a couple years later at my family's bookstore, the Argosy, in New York City.
How cool is that?
I was shoulder to shoulder with Tom Hanks at an Orioles game a few years back.
Is that right? Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I snapped a quick photo of him for my blog as he was making his way up the aisle. I mean, I could have reached out and he would have shook my hand, but instead I reached for my camera and took a picture. And I don't know. I mean, I live right in the heart of New York City. You'd think I'd be seeing famous people all the time, but I just don't ever run into celebrities. It's weird. A lot of famous people do go into the bookstore, but I don't know. Just in my everyday life and at baseball games, you know, I'm always hanging out in the bleachers, man. I'm like 400 feet from home plate. So if Cameron Diaz is at Yankee Stadium to see A-Rod, she's sitting front row by the dugout, and I'm hanging out in the bleachers trying to catch a long ball. So I don't know. I guess I don't run into too many famous people in that sense.
How the average person, if they started becoming a ball hawk, how long should it take them to know what they're doing? I mean, is it a full year to really get down all the different ways to do it?
Well, I've heard in the past that it takes like 10,000 hours to really become an expert at something. I don't know that that's necessarily true because there are certain things that are easier to master than other things. I would say that it's a lot easier to become a skilled ball hawk now than when I first started doing it, because when I began, there were no blogs written by other ball hawks. There was no instruction guide or book teaching you how to do it. But at this point, it's like, you know, every game that I go to and every ball that I catch, I blog about it in great detail and show photos and diagrams sometimes on my blog. So if anyone reads the blog, I mean, that would give them a huge head start in terms of figuring out where to go and when to be there and what to bring and what to say. And an extension of that would be the final third of my new book, The Baseball. So it's like between the blog and the book, it's like that's everything you'd possibly need to know. And beyond that, it's just a matter of your own athletic ability, your own sort of nuttiness and obsessiveness if you're willing to go to a lot of games, and really just like your baseball instincts, how quickly you pick up on things. There, I sort of feel like I have an intuition for where the balls are going to go, and I'm very good at sensing opportunities, and I'm still finding myself improving and getting more just aware of things as they develop in the stands and at games, and that really can't be taught. That can only be learned by going to dozens and hundreds of games. But, you know, if someone reads all my stuff, there's no reason why they can't catch at least one ball at just about every game. Now, I've gotten to a point where I'm averaging close to 10 balls a game. But, you know, catching a handful of balls at a not too crowded batting practice really shouldn't be that hard for anybody based on all the tips that I've laid out.
Now, how many, you take a lot of pictures yourself. How many of your pictures are in this book?
There are more than 100 photographs in the book, and this actually cost me a lot of money because every photo, I basically had to provide paperwork and documentation to my publisher to show them and to prove and to make them feel reassured that I did have the rights to use the photo. So now if it was any photo that I personally took, well, there was no problem there. I just said, well, I took the photo. End of story. Now, there were also some photos that some friends of mine took that they were willing to let me use for free. But there were some photos that I couldn't find anywhere else except, you know, in the archives of some major photo agencies. And I had to pay quite a bit of money for some of the photos. There's a picture in the Death by Baseball chapter.
That's a gruesome picture.
Of Herb Score, who famously got hit on the eye with a line drive in the 1950s, pretty much wrecked his career. A picture of him that I had never seen before, with a huge bandage wrapped around his head, with his eye, you know, sort of like peeking out from below the bandage. And I don't want to say how much I paid for that, and it did come out of my own pocket, but it was a number of hundreds of dollars, and, you know, sure, the book would have seemed just as good without that photo, but I love visuals in general. I'm actually not a huge reader myself. I know that's sort of like blasphemy for a writer to say that, but I read very slowly, and I just feel like my life is so busy that I don't make that much time to read, not nearly as much as I would like. So I didn't want to write a book that was going to be tough to read. I didn't want to write a book that looked and felt like a phone book or a textbook. So there's a lot of photos, and there's no section in the book that's longer than like 5 pages. It's all sort of broken down into little sort of like bite-sized sections and chapters. It's great bathroom reading. I'm not embarrassed to say that. And it just, I think it flows really well, and it's very conversational and fun, and there's a lot of dense, rich historical stuff in places that, you know, you might need to comb through a little bit slower, but I just tried to have fun with it. That's kind of my outlook in life in general. It's just how can I have the most fun and help other people have fun.
It sure is a lot of fun to read. Now, I haven't asked you yet how old you were when you went to your first game and when we first started doing this. I mean, how many years have you been doing this, and when did you first go to your game? When did you first go to a game?
I was 6 years old, and it was bat day at Yankee Stadium, and my dad took me. I didn't even know what batting practice was then, because my dad was not really a sports fan, and no one in my family is to this day. So we aimed for a first pitch arrival, and then, of course, we got lost, and he took a wrong turn, and we hit traffic, so we didn't get to the game until, I think, the third inning. Then we ended up sitting way up at the top of the upper deck on the first base side, and I'm in the middle of a long row of fans, and they're all twice my size. And I had my glove, you know, I was screaming, hit it here, probably annoying everyone around me. And then, of course, we had to leave in the eighth inning to beat traffic. So I went home empty-handed that day, and looking back, I'm not surprised, but I was extremely disappointed. And for 6 years after that, I continued going to games and not catching any baseballs. And it wasn't until I was 12 that I finally learned about batting practice. And when I attended BP for the first time in 1990, I got two baseballs thrown to me by pitchers on the Mets at Shea Stadium. And really, there was no going back from there.
Wow. Wow, that's just awesome. And this book is awesome. And we just about run out of time, and I know you have to go. But it's just been such a pleasure to talk to you. I mean, we could talk all night about this book. There's so much in it. It's so rich with things we haven't even talked about yet. So I thank you so much, Zach. This is just wonderful.
Well, it was great talking to you, and I'm always thrilled to talk about baseball and to talk about snagging baseball.
Yeah, I love doing this, and I hate saying goodbye sometimes to the authors. I'm having so much fun asking them questions, but you can read all the rest of it in the book called The Baseball by Zach Hampel. It's out from Anchor Books. It's in all your bookstores now, and you can go and get it now, and I'm sure you will. And this has been David's Book Talk, and we'll talk to you next time.